I don't want tremendous feedback.
No, just good feedback, right?
Thanks, everybody. Hey, this is my first time. This is pretty cool. This is really cool. I mean, I like that big, wide path here right in front of me. So don't everybody jump into the aisles and rush me at the same time. This is a neat story and just neat what God has been doing in this group and providing this place. I was talking to Bob a little earlier about some of the other benefits that come with this building. So it's just kind of neat how God continues to bless and provide. I'm thinking this might be the amount of light that I'm going to have. Is that true? Can I borrow one of these? Oh, let there be. How about that? Let there be light. That's all I needed. Well, it's interesting. I think I heard Richard say the same thing, but I got here and I think I said good morning to three or four of you. Because I'm just somehow just used to seeing you in the morning. And so if I said good morning to you, I apologize. I know it's in the evening. And I wish somebody would have given me a little heads up about the way the restrooms work, because those doors don't shut right away. Yeah, that kind of, wish I would have had a little bit of a heads up on that one. Yeah, it's kind of like, it's just down this way, and the door doesn't shut for a while. So you got to get used to that. Well, I am just thrilled to be with everyone tonight, and it's a beautiful December evening, and I just love the Christmas carols. It's a great way for us to get started. You know, when I was a kid growing up in Arizona, there wasn't a whole lot to do besides just kind of beat the heat, you know. You would just try to complain a lot. You'd try to eat as many popsicles as you could, and you would just try to find some way to get involved with forgetting that it's so hot outside. Well, one of the things that we used to do to escape just the drudgery of living in the desert was just kind of imagine and play and do silly things. And one of the things that we used to imagine and play with was a motorcycle. We actually had an old beat-up motorcycle in our backyard, and I still don't know where we got it or why we got it. And the reason that no one really used it anymore is because my brother had laid it down. Oh, is this it right here? Yeah. It might be the picture that you can't see all that great, but it's a Honda 150. And what was interesting about this motorcycle is, like I said, it was out of commission. So all we did was stand on it and play on it and imagine that we were riding a motorcycle. And so there were times that I was kind of redoing the scene from The Great Escape by Steve McQueen, if you remember that, you know, where you're kind of jumping over things and riding the thing and just really leaning into this. And there's times that I try to relive the Evel Knievel scene over Caesar's Palace, you know, just with slow motion kind of land how he landed and then just kind of continue to go over the bicycle, the motorcycle. There's times I'd stand on the top, you know, pretending like, kid, you really do this, you know. But what was interesting about it is, like I said, it never worked. It was just this old beat-up motorcycle. And the reason it didn't work was my brother had laid it down in the alley and messed himself up and messed up the bike, and we just used to play on it all the time. Well, our next-door neighbor was a brain surgeon. And, you know, when you're a brain surgeon, everything kind of comes easily. And so he was kind of bored and said, you know what, could I buy that off of you, off of our family? I'd like to fix it up. My dad was like, sure, I don't care. That's nothing he wanted to do. And so then my motorcycle went away. And I was like, dang, that was a lot of fun to just sit on that thing and pretend. Well, it was probably about a year later that he told us, do you want to see the old motorcycle? And when we walked over there and looked into the garage, you couldn't see it as well, but the picture that's right here is a restored version of this motorcycle, a 1966 Honda 150 touring bike. And when we looked at this in this guy's garage, we were flabbergasted. We're like, how in the, this can't be the same bike. There's no way that this is the same motorcycle. All the rubber was fresh, everything was clean, all the paint was clean, all the chrome was polished, the cloudy stuff over the speedometer was gone. I mean, the lights, everything worked. It was like, what in the world happened to this thing? And this guy had taken this old motorcycle and put some time and love and energy and creativity and patience into it and turned it into this incredibly beautiful showroom piece. You know, I love stories about restoration like that. Because it's something I would love to do. It's something that's cool when you actually see it. And I think a lot of us like restoration. We like to see things go from one state to another state. How many people watch home improvement shows? Anybody? It's kind of nice to see somebody else do the work and kind of make you go from that ugly thing to something beautiful, right? What about cooking shows? Does anybody like cooking shows? The reason I like cooking shows, but at the same time I hate them, because you always want to taste what they're doing and you can never taste what they're doing. It's just frustrating. But they basically take raw ingredients and turn it into something absolutely beautiful. You take something that could never work and it turns into a beautiful home. You take a pile of ingredients and you turn it into this incredible dish. For those of you ladies who are married, wouldn't you like a little makeover going on in your house? Would you like to put your husband up on the extreme spouse makeover? That would be kind of a nice thing. Although you might, when they say it's time to move the bus, you know, you don't know if you'll really get what you're looking for. But what's interesting about these ideas and these shows and this concept is I think all of us deep down know we need a little work, don't we? We've seen something in us that's not the way it should be. It's not who we want to be. We don't react always the way we think we're supposed to. And there's something in all of us that knows that we need to be restored. And in our passage today, in Isaiah 62, what's really interesting is that Isaiah has this incredible vision of what a restored Jerusalem is going to look like. But what is this going to appear like? How is it going to function? What is the vision that he has of this? And so we're in Isaiah chapter 62. And if you remember, kind of where we are as we're ending up this study is that we're in the second major half where we're talking about the hope and consolation of Israel from chapters 40 to 66. And chapter 60, we took a look at the idea of Zion and the peace and the prosperity that will be there in Jerusalem. Chapter 61 apparently was award-winning from what I heard last week, so I was told that I can't top chapter 61. But anyways, Chris did a great job of just helping us understand the ministry of the Messiah and all that he's doing in the sense of serving the afflicted and who he is. And in chapter 62, what we see is this restoration of Zion being glorified really is a result of the ministry of what this suffering servant is going to do on behalf of Jerusalem. And if you have your Bibles with you, I want us to read Isaiah 62. It's only 12 verses. Excuse me, I'm reading from the New American Standard. And it says, "For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. And for Jerusalem's sake, I will not keep quiet until her righteousness goes forth like brightness and her salvation like a torch that is burning. The nations will see your righteousness and all kings your glory, and you will be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord will designate. You will also be a crown of beauty in the hand of the Lord and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. It will no longer be said to you, 'Forsaken,' nor to your land will it any longer be said, 'Desolate,' but you will be called, 'My delight is in her,' and your land, 'Married.' For the Lord delights in you, and to him your land will be married. For as a young man marries a virgin, so your sons will marry you. And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God will rejoice over you. On your walls, O Jerusalem, I have appointed watchmen. All day and all night, they will never keep silent. You who remind the Lord, take no rest for yourselves, and give him no rest until he establishes and makes Jerusalem a praise in the earth. The Lord has sworn by his right hand and by his strong arm, 'I will never again give your grain as food for your enemies, nor will foreigners drink your new wine for which you have labored. But those who garner it will eat it and praise the Lord, and those who gather it will drink in the courts of my sanctuary. Go through the gates, clear the way for the people. Build up the highway, remove the stones, lift up a standard over the peoples. But the Lord has proclaimed to the end of the earth, 'Say to the daughter of Zion, lo, your salvation comes. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. And they shall call them the holy people, the redeemed of the Lord. And you shall be called sought out, a city not forsaken.'" What's interesting is I think to kind of summarize what's happening in this chapter is that Isaiah is compelled by a vision of a glorious Jerusalem, a redeemed people of God who are going to be a witness to the world. That's kind of the outline of where we're going here. The idea is that he sees this vision of this glorious city of Jerusalem, and there's a description that he starts to lay out. I'm going to try to pull from all different places within these 12 verses. But what's interesting is there's three ideas that come about from this description that he's talking about. First of all, he's describing Jerusalem as this beacon, that it's a torch, it's a shining light. And, you know, when you think about the idea of what role that beacon or a light plays, it gives us a sense of direction. It gives us a sense of security, sense of warmth, a sense of where am I headed. If you think something like a lighthouse, A lighthouse is very important to give us a sense of, wow, I know where we're going. I know what's ahead of us. And yet it's something about this city that's going to provide direction and security to people, that this is going to be a different place, a very visible, different place that people will recognize. And with a beacon that it will be around the fact that there's salvation and righteousness there. That God has saved this city. He saved this people. They are no longer under threats from external problems and being hurt and captivity and all the history of how Israel's been treated. They're going to be saved from all of that. It's going to be a place of complete security because of how God has saved his people. And it'll be a righteous place. In other words, they'll be vindicated. This will be a place that people will be able to say, yeah, remember what people used to say about you, and how people used to chase you, and people used to take you into captivity and say all these things about you. This is going to be a right place, a righteous place, because you will be vindicated for your behavior, your belief, your devotion to your God. And so there's something about this city that will just gender this sense of, wow, this is a different place. Because God has saved these people. God has vindicated these people. And there's something about that that will be like a light. And it's interesting when I just try to think of it probably even more creatively. It's like, how can salvation and righteousness turn into a light? And what hits me a little bit is just this idea that when you think of people who are saved, and when you think people who've been vindicated and know that they're right and know that they're secure, there's probably a joy about them. There's probably a radiance about them. There's something about being saved and being right that brings joy. And there's going to be a light from this city because of what God has done with these people. Another part of this description is that he talks about it as a land of peace and prosperity. Now, this kind of harkens us back to Isaiah chapter 60, where there's a lot of different description about how God is going to bless Israel and how all these kings will come and their sons will return. And he's has a little bit of a glimpse reminding us of that from chapter 60. In verses 8 and 9, he talks about the idea that there's no more war. There'll be no plundering that will take place. You're not going to lose your crops to your enemies. You're going to be able to live in safety and security. You're going to be able to grow your own food and eat your own food and eat from the labor of your hands. There's this picture of peace. And when peace comes, and when people are free to do what they're designed to do, productivity takes place. And this is going to be a place where that kind of peace and productivity is developing and growing and flourishing. And not only that, but they'll be enjoying the fruit of their labor in the presence of God. They'll be giving thanks to him. They'll be eating in his courts. And there's just a sense of celebration and flourishing and bounty that's going to be real and true of this place called Jerusalem. And then lastly, he gives us the idea that this is going to be a place of international prominence. Again, this vision is a very big vision, and it includes this idea that Israel will have the world stage. In verse 2, it says, the nations will see your righteousness, and all kings your glory. In verse 7, Jerusalem will be a praise in the earth, the whole earth. And verse 12, they, that is the nations, will call them the holy people, the redeemed of the Lord, sought out, a city not forsaken. In other words, the whole world is going to see this city, this place, and say, wow, there's something special about this place. So the idea is that Israel's place in the world will be restored to the prominence that it's had and beyond. In other words, they're the subject of universal commendation. The world will know who Israel is. And they will rejoice. Instead of being an object of reproach and scorn, instead Jerusalem, Israel, will be restored to its former rank and its former privilege. You think about God's promise to Abraham that all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you. You think about the glory of David's kingdom. You think about the glory of Solomon's temple. And Isaiah is seeing this picture of this city that's so compelling to him because how beautiful and prominent it's going to be. Which is quite a contrast to where he is right now. And quite a contrast to where Israel will be in a short amount of time in captivity. But he's seen this picture of this place. And I love the way he says it at the end, that it's a city that's sought out. I don't know what cities you seek out. But this will be that kind of place. Like, I want to be there. I want to go there. I was talking to Mark before the service started tonight and asking him about a simple design maybe you've heard of. It was a t-shirt that had three cities on it. Do you remember the cities? London, Paris, and Rome. And then you could insert your own. Cleveland, Winnemucca. I'm not sure how you'd put it out there. But it's interesting how when people think of a city they want to go to, it's not Wilsonville. Wilsonville did not make the C-shirt, you know. It's London, it's Paris, it's Rome. Mark was saying at one time they had 3,500 accounts of people selling that T-shirt. Because there's something about seeking out a place of renown. And the thing is that Jerusalem is going to be this place of great renown, that people will seek it out. They will want to be there. And what's interesting about it, when you think about cities and the reputations they have, they have reputations, don't they? When you think of New York City, it's a place with financial power, isn't it? There's a lot of stuff going on there financially. When you think of Washington, D.C., you think of a place of a lot of political power, don't you? When you think of the Silicon Valley area, there's tremendous technological power that's in that city. When you think of Los Angeles, you think of all the cultural power with the TV shows and with movies and all the way that Los Angeles can move the culture. And when you're going to think upon Jerusalem, it's going to have its own sense of what it's about. And it's going to be a moral power. And what I mean by that is it's not just going to be a place where everybody does what's right, nobody speeds, and no one spits on the sidewalk, and there's no jaywalking, you know. It's this idea that there will be a wholeness to this people. They will be a righteous people. They'll be people who love mercy, who do justly, who walk humbly with their God. There's a sense of harmony and shalom in this place that people will want to be there. That's the kind of place that he's saying. It's this beautiful description, this grand vision of what Jerusalem is going to be because of God's work. Well, the idea is not only because it's so compelling to him, but also this city, it's making him proclaim about it and talk about it. This grand vision is not only just this beautiful city, but it's causing him to be compelled to talk about it. He proclaims it. First of all, in verse 1, he says, "For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent, and for Jerusalem's sake, I will not keep quiet." You see, he's saying, I cannot but speak. He's received a picture of how glorious this place is going to be. He cannot stop talking about it. It's so crystal clear about how wonderful this place is going to be because of what God has done that he's compelled to tell other people about what it's like. It's like if you remember when Jesus was with his 12 in John chapter 6 and there were people who walked away from him because what he said was too hard to hear. And he said to Peter and the others, "Do you guys want to leave also?" And Peter said, "To whom shall we go, Lord? You have the words to eternal life." In other words, Peter had seen the real thing. You remember in Acts chapter 4 when Peter and John were preaching the gospel and the synagogue leaders grabbed them and were trying to say, "Hey, you got to stop that and knock that off and cut that out," and you know all the other things that they're trying to tell them to do to stop it. And the thing that's so interesting about how the leaders of Jerusalem, what they said about Peter and John, they said, "Now they observed the confidence of Peter and John and understood that they were uneducated and untrained men. They were amazed and began to recognize them as having been with Jesus." You see, these men had seen the real thing, and they could not be quiet about it. And this is what Isaiah is experiencing, is that when he sees the work of God, when he sees what God is going to do to this place, and how these people are going to be redeemed, his people, he cannot stop telling them about it, and reminding them, and encouraging them to hope and look for and pray that God will do what he's talking about. But it's not only him going on in the chapter. He's encouraging other people. On verse 6, it says, "On your walls, O Jerusalem, I have appointed watchmen. All day and all night, they will never keep silent." Now, it's a little unclear. Is this God maybe saying this? Is this maybe Isaiah that's saying this? It seems to fit in with what Isaiah is doing himself. So it's reasonable to believe that maybe he's speaking to other teachers who are prominent at the time, leaders of Israel, others that will lead. But the idea he's trying to say is those of you who care about Israel, those who know God and know his salvation history, you need to be diligent to keep exhorting people to believe, to keep believing about what he has in store for us, to be diligent about that. And the description about the people on the wall is less about defense, like we need people to defend us, we have God to defend us. The idea he's trying to draw upon is that these watchmen are people who are diligent. They're alert. And he's calling those who care for Israel, those who care for the people of God, to have the same alertness and the same vigilance of proclaiming what God is going to do now and in the future. He calls us to be like that. He reminds them, and this is so interesting, he reminds them, in a sense, to hold God to his word. It's really kind of a funny way when it says about reminding him. It's like, really? We have to remind God of stuff? That's not really how we should understand it. We shouldn't take it as, hey, guys, if you don't remind God about his promises, then he might not come through with them. That's not what he's saying. The idea there is that these are people who are kind of in the remembrance ministry. They're helping us remember what God has told us, what God has promised us, what God is going to do. So he calls on the spiritual leaders of Israel to say, remind the people of who God is and how he's worked on your behalf. The word zakar is the word that's mentioned here, and it does mean to remember. And it's frequently applied to a lot of different places, especially in worship and the praise of God and the celebration of worship. In Psalm 45:17, it says, I will cause your name to be remembered in all generations. Therefore, the peoples will give you thanks forever and ever. In Psalm 38, just the description of the psalm, it's a psalm of David to bring to remembrance. And so Isaiah is saying, guys, this vision is so powerful and so clear of what God is going to do in this place. You've got to be continually reminding the people to have hope and belief and faith of what God is going to do on our behalf. Especially when we find ourselves, he's projecting the future about what's going to happen. And when they're in captivity and have no hope and have no remembrance and see the city that's been destroyed, how in the world could they have hope? And he's calling them, you've got to remind people of what God has promised us and rehearse his truths. I was driving recently, probably a couple weeks ago, and for some reason, maybe it was having our kids home from college, the thought hit me. And for those of you who don't know me, I took a bumpy road to the altar. My wife and I dated for about 4.5 years off and on, and included a broken engagement, and Junior here had to get some counseling and figure out what the heck was going on in his life. And it's really kind of interesting. And one of the things that was going on in my own mind is that I'm a person who's just got a lot of anxiety. I've just come from kind of a place of a lot of anxiety and made my own choices that have made me more anxious about life. And the thing that I was so anxious about is this random thought would hit me about getting married. And I just didn't think I could do it. I don't think I could provide. And the picture that came into my mind, because being in ministry, it was like, wow, I've got to now kind of trust the Lord to fund our ministry for 2 people. And what if we ever have children? How's that going to work? And the thought that kept hitting me is, I don't know if I'm going to be able to pay for college for a 3rd child. I had no idea that I was going to have 3 kids. But this is the thing that kept burdening me is, God, I don't know if I can do this. I just don't think I can do this. And God kept saying, you need to trust me. You just need to trust me. What are my promises? That I will provide for you. That I will take care of you. Isn't that what my word tells you? And I had to keep rehearsing that and keep rehearsing that. And then the first kid comes along and I had to rehearse it. And the second kid comes along and I had to rehearse it. And the 3rd kid comes along and I had to rehearse it. And I've had to keep rehearsing that God, you are going to take care of us. I had to remind myself and remind my wife and remind my family. You know what's interesting is that as these 2 kids were back from college, they go to an out-of-state school that's really expensive. And do you know God is providing for them? Because of their academic merits. Half of the bill has been paid just because of that. God introduced my wife to a couple people when CBF was around, and a couple of moms got together and they tried to be like Bill Gates, and Janet bought Apple when it was like $40 a share. And God has seen this money grow to where we're able to give them a certain amount of money to go to college. And then they work and have to make their own money. And you know what? They're getting through this thing. I've got a 3rd kid that at this point has 4 D1 basketball scholarship offers. So the money that we've set aside for her could go to the other 2. And I'm like, how did this happen? And God's like, well, you were reminding yourself the whole time, right? And see, this is what Isaiah is saying, is that because of what's ahead of us, because of where God is leading us and who God is and who we are to him. Remember his faithfulness. He is going to take care of you. And that's why he calls on them to be diligent, to not rest, to continually remind. It's so interesting. It reminds me of the parables that Jesus taught in the New Testament, if you remember, about the neighbor whose persistent knocking finally rewarded him with bread. Do you remember that? Or about the woman whose persistent asking received legal protection from the judge. Why? Because she kept asking. And Paul tells us to pray without ceasing. And Isaiah, because of this vision he's seen, because of what the future holds for us, says, you've got to remember and teach people to remember of who God is and where he's leading us and what he has in store for us. Well, this vision was not just about the city, about a place, but it's also about their relationship with God. His vision was not just about the glorious city, but it's also about the redeemed people of God. And as we think about that, they're going to have a new and restored status. And there's two metaphors that Isaiah uses to help the people of Israel understand how to have this hope and to see their future. The first metaphor is one of a crown. It says that they're going to be like a crown, a royal diadem in the hand of the Lord. And when you think about the idea of a crown, it's like, well, gee, is it going to be put on their head like they'll be able to lead? I think there's implications of that because they'll be a world leader. People will be coming to them. But it's interesting that it's in his hand. It's not on their heads. Why is it in their hands? What's interesting, when you just think about the idea of a crown and you look at it, it's a beautiful piece. It's a piece of prominence or glory, but it's also an exquisite piece, right? You know, most crowns aren't the Burger King crown, you know, that's just kind of paper and some bad gold on it. This is an artisanal thing. It's a beautifully handcrafted thing. It's a beautifully made thing that is something to behold and look at. And he says, Israel, this is what you are to me. You are something to behold. You are a beautiful thing in my hands that I have produced and brought along and nurtured. You are a crown. That's what you are to me. It's this beautiful, beautiful thing. And the second metaphor he uses is this idea of a marriage or a relationship. What's interesting about that is there's kind of three ways that he talks about this idea of a marriage. First of all, he talks about an abandoned marriage. He says that this marriage is similar to a wife who's been abandoned who's now remembered. And that's the image that you have here, that he says that you are no longer forsaken as a woman who's been cast aside. It's a wife who's been abandoned. He says, that's not who you are. You are no longer that. That description no longer fits you. Why? Because of how I see you. And how I see you is that my delight is in you. You are no longer forsaken. Matter of fact, you are somebody in whom I take all of my pleasure and all of my delight. That's how you're to see yourself, Israel, that you are loved on that level. And this is a new name that she's been given. If you remember, Israel was the idea of one who wrestles with God. This is a new name. My delight is in her. The first name is about kind of what Israel was doing towards God. It was a wrestling match, which kind of is an interesting picture about their relationship with God, right? This is a whole different name and a whole different picture, and it's God-centric. It's how I think of you. It has nothing to do with what you're doing. It's all about how God looks and sees and feels about Israel. He says, my delight is in you. And he goes on with this metaphor in a different way. It's kind of interesting because he says, your land will no longer be desolate, but be married. And it's kind of like, okay, what does that mean? That's a little weird. How do you marry a land? I think the idea here is that the people, and we'll see as this unpacks a little bit, that the people in Israel themselves, there will be no longer a disconnect between who they are as Jewish people and followers and where they live. There'll be a harmony. They'll be committed. They'll be loyal. They'll be, this is my place. This is where I worship. This is the sense of prosperity that's going to take place because, in a sense, the people who are coming back and the way the city is growing, it's almost as if the people of Israel say, this is my place. I am committed to this place, as if someone's marrying somebody and committing to them. It's so interesting. In Isaiah 64, we get that idea. Actually, 60, verse 4. Because if you remember in there, it says, your sons will come from afar, and your daughters will be carried in the arms. And so the idea is that this place will be such a wonderful, beautiful place that Jewish people are going to be coming back to Jerusalem. They will be committing themselves to the place where they've come from. They'll be committing themselves, in a sense, as in a marriage, to be saying, this is my place. It's really interesting to think about the repatriation of the nation of Israel. In 1950, Israel passed a law called the Law of Return. And basically what it was is that the first line of the Law of Return says this: every Jew has the right to come to this country. So they're basically saying, hey, we're a nation again, and guess what? you can come home. You can come back. You can come back to this place and be committed to this place. It's interesting, from the website of the Jewish Agency for Israel, the website says, with the inception of the state of Israel, 2,000 years of wandering were officially over. Since then, Jews have been entitled to simply show up and request to be Israeli citizens. And people are coming back to this place. They're committing themselves to this place in fulfillment of what Isaiah is talking about here, that people will come. It's interesting. You can download a 30-page pamphlet called Israel, Make Your Move, A Guide to Aliyah. And the word Aliyah is the idea of ascent. It was the word used that as people would ascend to Jerusalem for high holidays and Passover. You would have to make an ascent to it. And the idea is ascend back to your home. And we're seeing this fulfilled even as we're here today. So the other idea about this marriage, and lastly, and to me this is a little tricky to try and understand, because in verse 5, some of the translations say it a little bit differently. What I read for you in the New American Standard is also true in the ESV and the New King James. It reads, "For as a young man marries a virgin, so your sons will marry you. And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God will rejoice over you." Well, it's interesting. The NIV reads it as such. If you have the NIV, maybe you're like going, hmm? It says here that as a young man marries a young woman, so will your builder marry you. A bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. So you're like, who's the builder? This isn't Bob the builder. It's not some contractor that's just doing some basic work there. And what's interesting about it, in just the limited research that I did on it, what's interesting about some of the translation that happens there is the word that's translated for son can also be translated as the idea of a restorer or a builder, depending on how the vowel points are being used in this word. And so what's interesting about it is think, well, who is this builder? Is this restorer? The one who's brought you back, the one who's restoring you. In other words, you will have a closeness of relationship with this builder, this restorer, your God. It will be like the love of a marriage. And what's interesting about this, and I think the NIV has a little bit closer in that idea, that it's God himself who is, in a sense, marrying his people. And not in a literal way, but in the sense of love and commitment to them. Because if you look at the verse, it's interesting, to try to at least help me to think about it, was that in the Hebrew, a lot of times there's parallelism, that the first half and the second half are similar. And in this verse, you have kind of this idea of the parallelism in the first half of verse 5. It says, for as a young man marries, if you start in the second half of this verse, it says, as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God will rejoice over you. So it makes sense that the first half of the verse reflects a person with a person and a God with a person. The bottom line basically here, without trying to get too sophisticated, is that God himself has this close commitment to his people. They are his redeemed people. And the idea of a marriage is a very powerful metaphor that he's using, that this is the level of love and commitment that I have for you. And just as a bride and a bridegroom are going to celebrate, and just as a groom is going to celebrate over his bride, that's exactly how I feel and think about you, Israel. That's how I care about you. You're not just some pet project. You're a people that I love, that I want, and I want to be in relationship with. And all of this is because of his grace. I mean, when you think about the nation of Israel and the choices they've made and the things they've done and the disobedience, God continually comes after and comes after and comes after. He says, I still love you. I still care about you. I still want you. You are my people. So this is going to be a beautiful place. It's going to be a place of prominence, but it's going to be a place where the people of God dwell. Well, lastly, God's exaltation of Israel will also be a witness to the world. And as we close out this chapter, God's salvation and judgment will be shown to the world as his love for Israel. And we're going to see in the next chapter more about God's judgment, but as we close here in the idea of his salvation and his commitment to Israel, is that his salvation is very clear. Verse 11, lo, your salvation comes. And it's not just a concept, it's a person, as we've been exploring. It's not just that it's going to be salvation from captivity, that will definitely happen, but it's a bigger picture of what salvation will be about as we celebrate Christmas and Christ and the Messiah and about a future. But the idea is that God is going to save his people. That's what his ultimate goal is to save them and to make them his own. In verse 12, it says, they will call them the holy people, the redeemed of the Lord. and you will be called sought out, a city not forsaken. And what I think is interesting is to try to think about this final scene. To me, it was rather difficult to figure out. Because when you look at verse 10, it says, go through the gates, clear the way for the people, build up the highway, remove the stones, lift up a standard over the peoples. And as I was trying to wrestle with this, I was trying to figure out who are the people that are involved in this verse. Because it's like, who is it that's supposed to go through the gates? And which gates are they supposed to go through? And who is being prepared for? And what's interesting, without trying to go through a lot of that, the Jews who are coming out of Babylon to go through those gates? And the Babylonians need to clear the way for them? Is it the Jews that are going through the gates of other cities? Some people are suggesting that between Babylon and home, there are these other gates that cities would welcome them in. So they're supposed to go through those gates, and the people who live there are supposed to prepare the way for Israel to come. Is it possible that it's the Jews who are going to go through the gates of Jerusalem on their way in as they leave Babylon and go in? But if that's the case, who's preparing the way for them? Are they preparing it for themselves? So to me, it was a little bit confusing to understand this idea, and we can get some clarification as we go through the series. But I think what's interesting also is it possible that it's looking at this city, and it's looking at this city in the future, and that maybe that part of what needs to happen here is that the people who are there, the Jewish people who are experiencing God, maybe they're to go through the gates to go out of their gates and clear a path for those who've come back to be in this city, that all these nations and all these kings who are there, who want to be there, that they need to be welcomed into the place of God, that they need to understand who God is, that they need to be, that they're invited to be in this community, that they are glorifying, that they are looking at, that they are watching and saying, this is an amazing place. Because as you see how this ends, what is it that they're saying? The outsiders, those who are on the outside looking, these nations, these kings, they're saying, this is a sought after city. This is a city that was once forsaken and it is no longer. There's a longing in these people. There's a curiosity in these people who are outside of these gates saying, who is this people? Who is this God that would redeem these people? And I wonder if it's possible that the idea is similar to what Jesus said in the idea of this banquet, that let's invite other people in. Now, I might have that totally wrong, but the idea of the picture to me is that Isaiah has this vision of this incredible future for Jerusalem. And it's a beautiful place of prosperity and peace where God is reigning, where people are living in harmony. And all these kings and all these nations are looking at that saying, wow, that's an amazing place that they'd love to be a part of. Well, how does any of this work for us today? Unless you're planning on downloading that pamphlet and getting back to Israel, which you might be, which is great. But how does this work for us? What are we to think about this compelling vision that Isaiah had? About this vision of the future, about the redeemed people that they are, and about what this witness means. I think my question is, when you think about kind of where you are, especially maybe this Christmas, how compelling are you? Are you kind of caught up in the story very much, or are you not really all that compelled, if you're honest? You know, your spot of maybe telling other people about what God's doing in your life? I know sometimes for me, I'm not all that compelling because there's not that much going on in my relationship with God. And yet Isaiah is reminding us that the reason that we're compelled is because of the things that we're seeing and experiencing. And if you're not feeling very compelling around this Christmas season as we start to think about and wonder about the amazing miracle that God became a human being, what's going on with you? How are you doing with the Lord? Are you weighed down with worries and fears and doubts? That the things that are making it hard for you to see what this Christmas season is all about, it's all about Him coming. It's all about Him answering and fulfilling His promise. I love what Dan read earlier about Simeon. There was a promise that Simeon was holding on to. And see, Isaiah's received a promise that is going to become true. And how do we know that? Because God did that with Jesus. He brought a Messiah. That's what we're celebrating. So are you connecting with this bigger story that God is a person of His word, that He's brought the Messiah? And that's a compelling story. If you're not, Maybe you need to think and reflect about the second thing that Isaiah talked about. And that is that if you belong to Jesus Christ, do you know that God's delight is in you? Do you know that he really, really loves you? It's so interesting when Jesus was being baptized and he comes out of the water and there's a voice from heaven that says, "Behold my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." And do you know that if you belong to Jesus Christ, that's exactly how he feels about you? That is exactly how he feels about you. Because he doesn't look at your sin and your doubt and your track record and just say, "I don't know about that person." They look at you, he looks at you and says, "They belong to me. And all of my delight is him. All of my delight is in her. They don't have to perform for me. They're right because of what Jesus has done." And if you're feeling disconnected from the Lord as you approach this season with Christmas, you've got to dwell on that. You've got to remind yourself. You've got to do the work of remembering that the reason he came was to die for you and for me. And if you believe in him, you belong to him. You have this glorious future ahead of you. He delights in you. So as we just move towards this season, I just want to encourage you to say, "God, how does it the vision that Isaiah sees in this chapter, how does that relate to me? How can I understand my faith and my future in a way that's compelling? How can I understand the delight and the love that you have for me like you had for Israel is how you think about me and how you feel about me?" Because Israel belongs to God. You belong to God. It's interesting, just to close, there's a story about a boat builder who had quite a great reputation, and it kind of reminds me a little bit of Dave King, if you ever saw the boats that he made. But this is a boat builder who really paid attention to detail. He loved making these crafts. And one time he made a boat that was just quite spectacular. It took a lot of time, a lot of energy. And he made it and wanted to see if this thing could work. So he went out and put it on kind of a larger lake and was kind of monitoring it and making sure that it didn't get too far away. But it got progressively a little farther, and then a puff of wind hit it and it really took it. And he tried with all of his might to try and find a way to get this boat back. He tried to follow it and track it and lost sight of it, and it was gone. It was about a couple years later as he's kind of doing his woodworking thing and, you know, going all these different shows and checking all these things out. He sees this boat that looks kind of like his, but it's kind of banged up. And he goes, "That can't be my boat." And he goes over and he looks at this boat with certain markings that he put on, and he's like, "Oh my gosh, this is the boat that I built. It's a wreck." And he tries to tell the guy that, "Hey, this is my boat." He goes, "Yeah, right, it's your boat. Tell me about it." He says, "You're going to have to pay for that." So he paid for the boat. He brings the boat, and he completely restores this thing back to its beautiful, original look. And then what he does is he puts this boat on display so that everybody who comes to his house or comes to his shop can see just how magnificent this thing is. And that's exactly what Isaiah is talking about here. That God created this relationship with this people called Israel, who went their own way, and he pursued them, and he took them, and he's going to restore them, and he's displaying them for the whole world to see, "These are my people. Eat your heart out." And that's exactly how he feels about you as a follower of Christ. Let's pray. Father, thank you very much. Just for history. Thank you for how you've worked in history. Thank you for just your faithfulness to Israel. Thank you for just the way you've given us a record of how you think and how you've treated your people and the future that you have for your people. And Father, thank you that we are part of your people. We're not Israel, but we're part of your kingdom. And we belong to you. We are so grateful that that's our future, one of hope, one of an incredible place with you. And Father, I pray for us here tonight. Father, I pray for anyone who's just feeling very distant from you, that you would remind them, that you would really help them to keep reminding themselves of what you've done for them and what you have for them. I pray for people here tonight who just don't feel any hope this Christmas. I pray that you would help them find their hope in you and how much you love them and care about them. And that the details that they're worried about, they can somehow keep handing over to you and keep rejoicing that they are known and loved by you and that you can help them, and you will. And lastly, Father, I pray that you would put on our hearts those around us that don't know you, that might be open to a conversation because it's Christmas, who might be open to coming to church with us because it's Christmas. But I pray that you would put on our hearts those who are outside of the gates, those who can see the promise and the beauty of belonging to you, but they're not part of your community. Will you help us to pray for those? Will you help us to talk with those and see new people come to Christ and enjoy a relationship with you? In Jesus' name, amen.